Well, good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Striffler, for that kind introduction and for inviting me to speak before the Development Committee. It's a great honor to be with all of you today. I want to start by showing you, talking to you about what I've learned from my work in health and development. And it's a very positive story. It's one that has my wife and I totally committed to give our money to these causes, and to give not only our money but also our time and our voice to the impact that this work has. And so overall, my message today is quite simple, and that is that aid works. Over the years, I've seen amazing progress. There are many ways of measuring this progress, but my favorite is the chart I'll show you now. I think it's more beautiful than any piece of art or the European anthem. You know, you name it, I think this speaks to what mankind's doing for mankind in a very strong way. And what it shows is that over the last 50 years, childhood deaths, that is the number of children under the age of 5 who die each year, has come down very dramatically. In fact, even as the population has almost doubled, the number of children who die every year is less than half. In 1960, it was over 20 million, and today it's about 8 million. And so that's a stunning accomplishment. A key reason that this has been achieved is the donor country generosity. That is, without foreign aid to buy vaccines, to improve farming productivity, to provide nutrition, without that, we simply wouldn't have achieved what you're seeing here. So European investments in global health and development is saving lives. It's treating and preventing disease. It's helping people lift themselves and their families out of poverty. And that's something to be proud of. However, despite this progress, as was mentioned, there's a lot of questions about development assistance. Particularly right now, with very tight budgets, many people wonder if Europe or others can afford to keep spending money on developing nations when they have their own economic problems. Other people have never been convinced that money spent on development has an effect or that it achieves lasting results. And today I want to share with you concrete information about why I believe those concerns are wrong and they do not stand up to scrutiny. I believe the aid that you support has a big impact, and especially now in these times, it's critical that you continue your leadership and show what we can achieve by working together and caring for each other. The European Union is a testament to cooperation itself, a membership union of peace, security, and economic prosperity, providing over 30% of the world's GDP. It's got unique experience in terms of regional economic integration. And building on this huge political and economic success, the European Union has shown global leadership through its generosity, saving millions and millions of these lives, and we should expect that to continue. I want to show you some of the phenomenal things that are happening as a result of this. And of course, I hope that encourages you to continue your leadership for being generous despite the pressures to cut spending, because only through that can we continue to make success. One of the most amazing statistics is that the European Union as a whole, and of course this is counting country direct aid as well as aid at the Commission level, it accounts for the majority of all aid in the world. And so the decisions you make here not only have a huge effect on overall aid levels, I believe they're also catalytic, that if you are more generous, that will influence others to be the same. To the degree that you cut back, I feel certain that will allow others to do the same. And so we're sitting here gathered talking about the biggest part of aid in the world and the most influential element as well. Your leadership continues. In fact, the European Union has continued to support the Millennium Development Goals, and it's reaffirmed the collective targets, 0.7% of GNI by the larger countries by 2015. So these commitments, the 0.7% of the EU15 and the 0.33% of the EU12, these are a very big deal. The chart here shows the progress of the EU15, and as you can see, the leading countries, the top four, are already above the 0.7%. And then you have a number that are down at the 0.4 to 0.5% level, which is very, very impressive. Of course, I'm sure you know that if you compare the United States on this scale, even though its aid in absolute is the largest of any single country, it would come out at about 0.22%, so not nearly as high as most of the countries we're seeing here. If you look at the EU12, you can see those numbers are not as large, still some way to go for the 0.33%, but still important in, that they come along as well. So Europe's role will shape global action and shape what happens to the people in need. I think it's very impressive that Europe, not only in terms of the magnitude of generosity, but by being willing to pool monies together at the union level, it has allowed there to be a more efficient giving. After all, for the recipient countries, the efficiency of dealing with one large donor in terms of having the technical expertise for particular programs, scale is very beneficial in these activities. And so working at the European level has helped reduce duplication. It's helped increase the kind of scrutiny that can go on. It's reduced administration costs. And that itself is a significant contribution. European aid has also been, for the recipient countries, more predictable through a long-term budget instrument like the seven-year budget, and by deciding in advance what your priorities are, you can give many of these countries the ability to look ahead, to take on projects that require many years of investment and building up expertise. And when a country has reasonable governance, that type of long-term aid flow has been shown to be more beneficial than those aid flows that come with only a year's notice, and so you can't plan and take advantage of it in quite the same way. The European Union is also good on transparency. There's a ranking where you came in the top 10 out of 58 donors in terms of publishing on the internet. Information lets people look at exactly how much money's being spent, what projects it's going on, and so that's a step forward. Also, the simplification, reducing funding instruments from 35 down to 10 is definitely going in the right direction to helping the recipients have lower overhead. The new Agenda for Change proposal, which is a focus on modernizing development policy and taking the coordination and increasing impact at a new level, that is a very good initiative that we're certainly in agreement with. So this is a critical year because the long-term budget that will be put in place, a critical year to really show leadership, to answer these questions of how is this important and how can we get the most out of it. I want you to keep in mind that there is concrete proof of this impact. Simply taking what's going on, the aid that's come from the European level, we can see that over 5 million children have been vaccinated against measles, 4 million births got additional attendance, 5,000 new health centers were built, 750,000 received ARV treatment, and over 7 million received a bed net. And as many as you who possibly can, I encourage you to actually go out and visit the locations, whether it's in Africa or Asia, to see the impact of your work. One of the great things I get to do in my work is visit Asia, including India, and visit Africa several times a year. And I get to go in and see the reduction in the number of kids going to the hospital for malaria. I get to go in and see the increased farming productivity and talk to the people that these things really reach. Now, I've been very interested to look and say, what do European voters think about these issues? And of course, if you phrase it in terms of amorphous foreign aid, sometimes you don't get a very strong response. But when you talk about development aid, over 85% indicate they find it important. 62%, when shown the current percentage spent, are in favor of increasing it, and 70% think it's an important value that really Europe ought to stand for. And so when explained properly, there is strong and broad support. And I think that is there to enable you to provide adequate funding for health and agricultural programs that achieve the highest impact. I think the direction you're taking in terms of focusing on the poorest countries is absolutely the right thing to do. That's one of the stories about aid that's critical, and I'll get to some specific numbers on this, is that it's not endless. As countries like Korea or Brazil or China get to a certain level of wealth, they not only should be able to support their own population, but they should move to actually be contributors to giving back. And so all of us should have the opportunity to focus on the poorest nations, the places that are in the greatest need. You know, today of 7 billion people on the planet, at least 5 billion of those are in a situation where either their own support or their government support should be able to take care of them. That still leaves 2 billion, which is a very large number, but far below, you know, less than 30%, whereas 50 years ago it would have been over 60% of the world was in need of foreign aid to maintain a reasonable lifestyle. And so there is progress in this idea of focusing that you've got in your framework is the right way to go about it. Now I want to focus on two areas. I'll start with vaccines and then move to agriculture. I pick these two areas because I think they are of particular importance. You know, the very first thing you need to do for a population to take care of itself is to improve the health and the agricultural productivity. Now, these happen to be the two areas where our foundation spends the vast majority of its money. And so this is where we have our expertise as well. It's not to make light of many other areas of development, helping with governance, infrastructure, and education. I think those are also important and often need to proceed in parallel with these activities. These happen to be very catalytic, very measurable, and areas where we can feel very good about how we're getting results. And every year we get even smarter about making every euro I have as much impact as possible. So vaccines are kind of miraculous. Although they can start out when they are first invented as being fairly expensive, over the period of a decade, their prices decline to be often a dollar and often quite a bit less than that. A measles vaccine, a polio vaccine are only about 12 cents today. If we look at some specific diseases that every one of which at one time affected millions of people, we can see that we've had very dramatic results. Smallpox is the most extreme of all. It became in 1977 the first disease that was ever completely eradicated. And so instead of several million people a year dying of smallpox, we now have zero people a year dying from that. And in fact, because we got all the way to eradication, we no longer have to provide that vaccine. So the investment that was made, that was actually quite modest, has had an unbelievable payback over time. We have other diseases that were pretty far along, although we don't have eradication. Polio, I'll talk about a bit, because that's the effort that I spend the most time on myself is finishing that polio eradication, but also diphtheria, measles, tetanus, awful diseases where by getting vaccines out and in broad use, we've had unbelievable reductions. In the case of polio, we started the campaign for the eradication of polio back in 1987. And at that time, over 300,000 children a year were paralyzed or killed by polio. And thanks to the investments that have been made, we have now eliminated 99% of those cases. So we're down to about 3,000 a year. And the way we do this is simple. We simply get the vaccine out, which is primarily a vaccine called oral polio vaccine, or OPV, which are a couple of drops. And I'm sure many of you have had a chance to go out and see these vaccination campaigns, or perhaps even yourself give children those drops. As I said, it's very inexpensive, and by simply getting every child to have those drops four or more times, then they become protected. We have several countries that still have polio cases. A few years ago, India had the most cases of all. And in fact, last year, India went 12 months without a single case. So the country that we expected to be the most difficult, we've now had a local elimination. And the countries we have left, we simply need to get the coverage up in the same way we did there. Some of the toughest countries will include countries in Africa, particularly Nigeria, and six others. And then in Asia, we have only two countries left, Pakistan and Afghanistan. So the total remaining work is Africa and then two countries in Asia. And there's every reason to believe that if we stay generous on this, stay focused on it, that over the next 2 to 4 years, we'll be able to add this as the second disease that has been eradicated. So vaccines are amazing. You give them to kids. You have the kids only come in a few times. It's very inexpensive because you're able to take the delivery system and put lots of vaccines through it. And we can invent new vaccines that are put into that system. And now when we think about why do young children die, fortunately, it's not because of hundreds of diseases. There's a small number of diseases that account for a very large percentage of these deaths. And so by simply inventing new vaccines, getting them to be low cost and getting them delivered out to children, we can cut that 8 million a year number very dramatically. And so here we see a chart that actually does this breakdown of the different causes. And what you can see is that pneumonia, which is an infection in your lungs, and diarrhea. Those are gigantic. Also, we have malaria in there at 8%. That's 8% on a worldwide basis. If you looked at it specifically for Africa, where most of the malaria deaths are, it would be more like 25%. So it's very dramatic there and not very large in other countries. That big block you see, the 41%, those are the deaths that take place in the first 30 days. And so that speaks to the need to really have good birth care attendants, to educate mothers in terms of keeping their children warm, starting breastfeeding. And so every one of the causes that are up here, there are investments, either inventing vaccines or getting vaccine coverage up, that can reduce these very, very dramatically. In fact, I can show you there's a lot of this burden. We actually have new vaccines that we simply need to get delivered. And that, if we just focused on that alone, we'd have 1.4 million of those deaths would go away. Last year was a great milestone for that, because at a pledging conference where European countries were absolutely critical, more than half of what was pledged, enough money was committed to get these new vaccines out to cover the percentages we see here. And so you should expect over the next 3 or 4 years, those 1.4 million children will no longer die. And so every year you'll have that benefit. And so you're actually saving lives at under $2,000 per life saved, which is just a phenomenal thing. The European community's generosity to this Gavi, that's the group that delivers these vaccines, has been absolutely fantastic. And so there's a commitment here that will literally save millions and millions of lives. In fact, this chart shows the various diseases that we're already spending the money, that these are the diseases that will no longer be there. Also, recently, you showed some flexibility in terms of taking and reprogramming some money for your Millennium Development Goal Initiative, and that also is targeted on things that will help children in substantial ways. Water, nutrition, maternal and child health, again, focused on the poor countries where the impact is quite incredible. There's many other things I could talk about in health, but let me move on now to agriculture. Agriculture is another big area that Europe funding is very critical, and another area for our foundation. You know, agriculture is a place where there are some great success stories. Certainly in the 1960s and 70s, the so-called Green Revolution was able to feed hundreds of millions in Asia that otherwise would have starved. And that was due to philanthropic and government money that created new seed varieties that were far more productive. Now, that did not happen in Africa. And in fact, Africa still has very low productivity. We see here the current per land area, hectare, acre type productivity. And you can see that the US and Europe are by far the most productive, and Africa's only about a quarter as much. Now, that's partly that you don't have irrigated land. You have more difficult soils, more difficult weather conditions. But with the right investments, we ought to be able to double that productivity. And so the kind of tragedy we've had, for example, 13 million people facing starvation in the Horn of Africa last year, if we actually invest in helping farmers, we can make that far less likely. In fact, we can take the lack of nutrition that is a very broad problem, over a billion people having to worry about whether they have enough food every day, and bring that down to zero. So we've seen success. Unfortunately, in the last decade, agricultural funding was reduced quite a bit. There was a sense that this was a solved problem. And in the last years, as we've realized as a development community that we need to get back into this kind of funding, it's been tough to increase the dollars. They've been increased, but not as much as would have happened if we hadn't been in tough budget times. And so I think this is a story that's particularly important. Whenever we have famine, you know, people go in on an acute basis, and again, the European Union has been the largest humanitarian donor for this Horn of Africa prominence, made a very, very big difference. The billion-dollar food facility is another example of showing flexibility, and it came exactly at the time it was needed and helped over 50 million people. And so where do we go in terms of permanent help to these farmers? You know, what is it that will allow these yields to double, and what would the effect of that be? Well, in fact, what we've seen is that improving agricultural output reduces poverty faster than any other investment. What happens is mothers who have more productivity in their field are able to spend on their kids and afford the school fees. In fact, my wife was in Africa with a lot of United States politicians just a few weeks ago, and they were it was phenomenal and inspiring for them to hear a woman who's a farmer in Tanzania talking about why she cares so much about her crop productivity, because she wants to invest in her kids. And you can see from this chart that doubling in productivity would lead to cut poverty in sub-Saharan Africa by over 40%. And so there is a very direct connection here. Well, now let me move on and take some of the criticisms that we often hear about aid. First, I think the thing that gets the most headlines is, what about corruption? And it's certainly true that if you go back in the past decades, where aid was mostly about friendship, and we were trying to have people in the Cold War on our side versus the other side, a lot of aid was given without really being focused on what the humanitarian effect of that aid was. Fortunately, we've gotten past that, and it's very different now, but the image of aid for many people is still what happened historically when there were other goals in mind. A great example of where I think we're doing a good job is the Global Fund. The Global Fund was created about 10 years ago, and it focuses, of course, on AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. And it's the leading funder, multilateral funder, for all three of those diseases. And when it was reported that Global Fund had found a small percentage of money misdirected, that created headlines. But in fact, what was going on there was exactly what we should want. It was the Global Fund's own tracking process that spotted that. It was quite small. They put more controls in place. And in fact, the measure that really counts is how much impact has Global Fund spending had? How many lives have been saved? How many kids avoided the kind of malaria that permanently damages their brain so that they can never develop physically and mentally by the appropriate metric, the Global Fund is very, very strong. And that's why our foundation is a huge funder of Global Fund, the biggest non-governmental supporter, and we believe that they're doing a great job on these things. In fact, when you work in health, it is an area where keeping corruption to be very, very small is reasonably straightforward, because you know what you're trying to achieve, you can look at those impacts, and you can follow the money. And things like vaccines, you know, nobody wants to stockpile vaccines. It's simply not attractive. And so health execution is uniquely good at making sure it gets down to the end recipient, including Global Fund. Global Fund has been a great recipient of the European Union. Other than the United States and France country donations, you've actually been the most generous of all. And that's why, you know, we can see just taking what come from you to the Global Fund, you can see the large numbers here, and including 3 million people who would not be alive today if it wasn't for that generosity. So we really, this is a great one where we need to get the word out that the money does not go in any meaningful sense for anything but the goals we have in mind. A second question, and one that I myself have when I first got into this field, is if you improve health and let more kids survive, aren't you simply increasing the population? And so it makes everything more difficult, feeding kids, educating kids, finding jobs for kids, creating stability. You know, won't this actually have a negative effect? And the fact is that this is absolutely wrong. It sounds like common sense, but it is wrong. Very quickly, when you improve health in a society, parents decide to have less children, because in fact what they're doing is having enough children to have an 85% chance of having two of those children survive to adulthood. And so in the world, we have countries that have good health and low population growth, and we have countries that have poor health and high population growth. And those are the only two types of countries. You never have good health and high population growth, or bad health and low population growth. Those two things are absolutely tied together. So for example, in Niger, mother today has on average over 7 children per family. And Niger has about the worst health statistics in the world. And so as we go in and provide malarial bed nets and provide new vaccines on a purely voluntary basis, that will change. And so the combination of education about reproductive tools, making those available, and these health interventions actually get you on the virtuous cycle that by lowering population growth, you can put the energy of the society into educating those children and get on a way to being self-sustained. I've got a graph that shows this that is actually from Hans Rosling. And if any of you have not seen Hans's speeches, I highly encourage you to get on the internet and look at that, because he's the most articulate about this change. Let me run this again. I'll say exactly what I've got here. I've got the children per woman on the bottom and the child mortality, the number per thousand, on the left. And so what we're going to do is we're going to watch it. We'll run it one more time, starting in 1961 up to 2010, the latest figures. And what you'll see, okay, so starting, you see countries all move to the left pretty much. That means smaller family size. And they all move down, which means lower child mortality. And now, when you get to 2010, the countries on the African continent are the ones shown in dark blue, and what in South Asian in the light blue there. What you see is that most countries are below 3 children per woman, except for some of these countries where we still haven't solved very acute health problems. So it's a very positive story. That what many people expected in terms of population growth did not take place, and now we understand why that's the case. The next criticism I hear of aid is that, you know, doesn't it sort of block them taking care of themselves, developing their own economy? And in fact, these public goods, whether it's infrastructure or health or farmers' education, those things actually facilitate market-based activities. Healthy kids can learn. Healthy kids do not have malnutrition that prevents them from being part of the economy. But we can actually take the history on this and look at it. Let me show you a map of Asia that goes back to 1968. And what I've done here, you won't be able to see the exact figures, but I've shaded this according to how much aid was as a percentage of their economy. And you can see there's a lot that are in this 2, 3, 4, 5%. You see India, that whole area, big aid recipient. You see Korea up there in 1968, over 3% of its economy in aid. And then we can move forward now to 2008 and look at the same thing. And what we see is a very dramatic shift. Yes, we see a few left. Afghanistan, still in that 5% area, Cambodia, Laos. But actually, you know, India's moved down to below 0.5%. Korea's the best case of all. They've moved from being a very substantial aid recipient to now a very generous aid donor with a commitment over time to move up to 0.5% of GDP in aid. And so, you know, this is the point that was made earlier about people really do graduate. Another key point I want to make, and this has to do with some legislation that you'll be considering in the future, is that helping poor countries understand what's going on with their resources is very important. In some cases, the value of their resources is very large, even compared with generous aid budgets. For example, in Uganda, the oil there is going to generate, it's expected, $2 billion a year, which is very large compared to the current government budget of $3 billion. And so understanding where that revenue is going, what's being paid for it, is that done in a transparent way, is very important. So I think having binding transparency requirements is important. And when I was speaking in front of the G20 in November, I talked about this. And I know that you have some legislation that you'll be looking at the next year that actually the way it's currently put forward, it's a strong piece of leadership because it applies to private and public companies. The United States recently passed legislation in this area, and so what we want to do is get a unanimity of the countries where you have mining and oil companies, and certainly getting Europe and U.S., Canada, Australia would give us a strong critical mass and make an absolutely gigantic difference. So I've shared with you my optimism about how we're moving forward with aid. And all of this aid, the impact of it improves as we innovate. What is innovation? It's a new vaccine. It's a new way of communicating with mothers. It's using cell phones to get best practices out there. It's these improved seeds. And so, you know, whether it's through your research budget or the type of research that we fund, aid spending will have greater impact because it will have these new tools. And this is why I'm optimistic, very optimistic, that we can solve these poverty problems. I'm impatient about that, and I know that the speed with which we do this will depend on it making this a continued priority. I was pleased to see your multi-year framework budget, as currently proposed, is quite generous in continuing to increase aid percentages and continues to be consistent with the long-term commitment that European countries have made. I think it'd be easy for the issues of the poorest for us to lose sight of those because, after all, they are far away. And if they were here in our countries, we would be doing more. But they are part of humanity, and so that's why I applaud the Parliament's focus on keeping these funds, even as there are tough, tough trade-offs to be made. I also see that you have a plan to increase your research funding, and some percentage of that will get spent on diseases for the poorest, including helping with the trials for those breakthrough medicines, where Europe's been a real pioneer in that. So there's a lot that your work can do. You should feel proud of what you've done, and you should stay strong in terms of pushing this forward. If European countries could get to that 0.7% level, would be very, very dramatic. That would generate 36 billion euros per year above current levels. And when you think of specific impacts, it is absolutely huge. You know, people nowadays don't like to talk about the monetary input. They like to talk about the impacts. And I certainly, as somebody who believes in measurement, agree completely with that. But you'd fully fund vaccines. You'd fully fund AIDS drugs. You'd fund clean water. You'd fund education. You would really meet a lot of the needs of the poorest and put us on the fastest possible path for having the kind of equality we believe in. I've got a copy of my G20 report here that as you walk out, you'll see it's available. It talks about the responsibilities, not just of the rich countries, but also of the middle-income countries and these the poorer countries themselves, how their policies, how their budgets can make a big deal. So I want to be clear that although I think that those of us who've done well have unique responsibilities, we should expect every country to play its role in this effective activity. And I think, you know, most important of all, if I can leave with one final thing, is that we do need to get the stories out about these successes. Europeans should feel great about their generosity. Only by knowing the success stories will they do what I think we all agree is best. And that is to be inspired and to continue. To increase that commitment in the name of humanity. Thank you.